region?
Achieved nothing. They killed the freedom in their mind when they killed Haj Qasim Suleiman. They killed justice in their mind and in their people when they killed Haj Qasim Suleiman. On the contrary, Haj Qasim Soleimani now is living in every person or a thinker who think that Haj Qasim Soleimani represents such slogans, freedom, justice, and liberty.
U.S. Army generals and strategists, as well as those who grieved him, agree that the commander of the Quds force brought the people of West Asia together and made the cause of fighting U.S. oppression a united struggle. Other virtual events to commemorate the memory of the Iranian commander were held by a group of activists in the form of Lebanese traditional storytelling. Through this art form, the writers tried to narrate to the people of Lebanon the story of Commander Qasim Soleimani and his significant role in thwarting U.S. plots.
The biggest shock was when the U.S. Army General Petraeus read a message which read, "I am Qasim Soleimani, the commander of our Quds forces. I am the one who conducts the Iranian policies in Iraq, Afghanistan, Gaza, and the entire region. And the Iranian ambassador in Iran is a member of the Quds force."
Many in the region who knew General Qasim Soleimani or learned about him after his martyrdom say they have no doubt that his martyrdom and the deeds done during his lifetime will lead to a complete liberation of the region. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The rollout of COVID-19 vaccines across Europe began this weekend. Healthcare workers and the elderly are getting the jab first. EU leaders have negotiated contracts for more than 2 billion vaccine doses from various suppliers. The first 200 million are the Pfizer and BioNTech vaccine.
It was important for me to get vaccinated in order to protect myself, to protect my family, and to be a part of the solution to stop the pandemic.
I felt honored to get the vaccine, and lucky, because I can finally feel more protected. What gives me relief is the prospect that after such a difficult and challenging period, we will finally get to see the light at the end of the tunnel.
The EU had planned the rollout to begin in unison across the bloc Sunday, but Hungary, Germany and Slovakia couldn't wait and began vaccinating on Saturday. The Netherlands says it won't start vaccinating until January 8th. The start of the EU's vaccine rollout comes after a more infectious COVID-19 variant was detected in the UK, which led to dozens of countries closing their borders to UK citizens.
Only if countries are looking and testing effectively will you be able to pick up variants and adjust strategies to cope. We must ensure that countries are not punished for transparently sharing new scientific findings.
The new variant has been detected in several EU countries as well. But vaccine developers say they expect their shots to work against COVID-19 mutations. More than 600,000 vulnerable people have already been vaccinated in the UK, which started administering the Pfizer jab 2.5 weeks ago. But ministers warn the country must double its vaccination target to 2 million a week in order to avoid a third wave.
I think it's an incredibly serious, incredibly dangerous moment. I think all of us always felt that January was going to become very hard and that we were heading into a very hard winter and hospital leave was being cancelled and ITUs were being got ready. And yet, nevertheless, I feel like we weren't ready for something quite as severe as this feels with the sheer level of caseload and the added effect of the variant virus building up our R number and making things so much harder than we expected.
The UK hopes to expand its vaccination programme with the rollout of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, which is expected on January 4th. There are now more COVID-19 patients in hospitals in England than there were during the peak of the first wave, and more than 71,000 Britons have died of the virus. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Mm-hmm. The Israeli regime has been intensifying its moves in the region as media revelations suggest it is intending to build a military base on the Yemeni island of Socotra. Yemen's Supreme Political Council has condemned these suspicious moves, promising Israel a decisive response in case it commits any stupidity against the Yemenis.
The Israeli move is not new, as it is running the region through some puppet regimes. The Yemeni position is clear as it was 6 years ago. We are in the midst of a war launched by Saudi Arabia with the tacit backing of American and Zionist regimes.
The Israeli media have boasted the arrival of the submarine to the Bab al-Mandab Strait after crossing the Suez Canal. An Israeli military spokesman also confirmed the move, claiming the step was taken to counter smart drones Iran could potentially launch from Yemen or Iraq.
The presence of Israeli entities in the Yemeni territorial waters dates back to the beginning of the Saudi-led aggression. It was just a year ago. There were plenty of statements by some Arab rulers pledging to stop what they claimed the Iranian expansion in the region. However, the same rulers are silent on the Israeli agenda. They have not only normalized their ties with the regime, but allow its submarines pass through the Red Sea.
It seems that the Yemeni army's possession of missile systems capable of reaching as far as Eilat has become a nightmare for Israel and its cronies. Tel Aviv knows that it will not be immune to the Yemeni retaliation. However, sending one of its submarines is yet another provocative move by Israel to set the region on fire.
Israel is still using Iran as a pretext for its interventions in the region, that despite the exposure of its agenda, especially in Yemen, which is suffering from a war led by Saudi Arabia, but was actually jointly hatched by some Arab regimes and their backers in Washington and Tel Aviv. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have expressed gratitude to Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani 1 year after his assassination by U.S. forces in the Iraqi capital Baghdad. Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani played a major role in strengthening Palestinian resistance movements against the Israeli regime.
We commemorate the first anniversary of the martyrdom of the great commander Haj Qasem Soleimani, who died for the sake of Jerusalem al-Quds. This anniversary comes amid great pressures on the resistance in the region. On this occasion, we vow to follow in the footsteps of the commander to liberate Palestine.
Following the assassination of General Soleimani, Palestinians held several events to pay tribute to the late Iranian commander. They considered him as a hero for Palestine and Jerusalem al-Quds.
On the anniversary of the martyrdom of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, we express our great gratitude for sacrifices he made for the sake of oppressed Palestinians.
The assassination of General Soleimani on Donald Trump's orders has sent shockwaves across the West Asia. Soleimani's memory continues to live in the hearts and minds of Palestinians in the blockaded Gaza Strip.
Palestinians will continue to remain steadfast and condemn the treason by some Arab countries that have normalized ties with the Zionist regime. On this occasion, Palestinians also vow to fight the occupation until regaining their freedom.
Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani was assassinated in a U.S. airstrike on January 3rd. Palestinians say martyr Qasem Soleimani has sacrificed his life for the sake of Palestine and Jerusalem al-Quds and has always supported Palestinian resistance against the Zionist regime. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Ahead of the first anniversary of the assassination of the former commander of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, General Qasem Soleimani, people are now holding commemoration ceremonies to pay respect to this late Iranian icon. We went to the city of Qom, where a movement called Resistance Youth Front is formed to support the cause of General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, who defeated the ominous phenomenon of Daesh. Scholars, youth, activists, and resistance movement supporters from countries like Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and India attended the ceremony to tell the world that General Soleimani's cause will not be forgotten.
It's a great pleasure for all of us, for all the people of the world who are free, who just think freely, okay? So such kind of attribution actually led us to not only memorize or recall their memory, actually also to follow their path. That is the path of humanity. That is the real war on terror, war against terror.
Shahid Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, they fight for saving the life of all mankind, of all Muslim and non-Muslim.
General Qasem Soleimani was assassinated by a U.S. strike on January 3rd last year when he was on an official visit to the Iraqi capital Baghdad. Hitting his convoy, the assault also led to the death of many others, including Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, deputy commander of Iraq's popular mobilization units, or Hashd al-Shaabi.
Apart from the ceremony held here, within the coming days, a number of other events will be held across Iran under health protocols to pay tribute to General Qasem Soleimani. Human Abedi, Qom.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of Halim, please.
Hi,
Kitty. Good morning. Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all. From the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O, the most merciful.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to the debate. I'm Behrouz Najafi. An affront to justice. That's how the UN has described President Trump's recent pardons for Blackwater mercenaries. Rights experts complain that a pardon for the four security contractors convicted of killing Iraqi civilians in 2007 undermines humanitarian law. UN experts have reminded the fact that based on the Geneva Convention, war criminals must be held accountable for their crimes even when acting as private security contractors. That's the topic of our debate show tonight. Stay with us for that. Now let's go to Washington, D.C. to our own correspondent, Dr. Colin Campbell. Colin, last week we were discussing the same issue from a different angle, and there was media blackout. The majority of mainstream U.S. media didn't mention this. So now the UN has taken it to a different level. It's now some kind of legal challenge. What about now?
That's right, and it looks like the media has picked up on it a little bit, really expressing outrage from some of the commentators that have remarked about the pardons that the president made for these contractors from Blackwater. As we understand, this was an egregious crime that was committed with the slaughter of innocent Iraqi civilians that were later the perpetrators of this crime now can walk free. So you have some media outlets, if they aren't just saying and stating what happened as a declarative, they're expressing outrage, anger, and just disbelief that these would be the people that the president has pardoned. Now, what is being looked at also is just the whole pardoning process. I think that the president has put a test on the whole system of who is pardoned and why. Usually it is for people who were not afforded equity in under the eyes of the law. Maybe there was a law that was misapplied, or maybe something that was done injudiciously, or something that was done a little bit too exacting or too draconian in method. Well, this time it seems that this was the president's privilege that he took to pardon people that he felt should be pardoned, or some people who were giving deference to the president. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why there are many people who are now questioning just the whole system of who is pardoned. Again, this is not the main story that is coming from U.S. media, but it is something that is being discussed, especially amongst those who are at liberty to discuss the topics of the day with a little bit more freedom in their rhetoric rather than just mm-hmm. stating the news of the day as a flat declarative.
Okay, thank you, Doc. Our own Colin Campbell in Washington, D.C. Now, joining me to discuss this a little bit and look at it from different angles, first will be former independent expert with the UN Human Rights Council, Alfred Desaires, out of Geneva. good to have you with us, Alfred. Welcome to the show. And, you know, as you know, these security contractors took the lives of Iraqi civilians back in 2007. On what ground has President Trump pardoned them?
Well, we have a culture of impunity in the United States, and this is only one of many cases. Constitutionally, the president does have the authority to pardon criminals. Except that in this case, basically, he's giving his blessing on murder, his blessing on a massive war crime. But it's not just the practice of granting pardons. It's also the consistent pattern of impunity for American soldiers to commit crimes and for private security companies whose members, and we had nearly 100,000 private security officials in Iraq at the time, and there were many other major crimes committed. It's not just this one in Nusra Square in 2007. I remember the crimes committed at the time of the rape of Fallujah, and we know the crimes committed in Guantanamo as a daily torture situation that has been repeatedly condemned by United Nations rapporteurs, and all of these persons involved in these crimes have enjoyed and continue enjoying impunity. As an American, I can say not in my name. I mean, I find it egregious, I find it outrageous. But as Campbell just said, the mainstream media doesn't like to carry these stories. I recall when I was a young student at Harvard, that was during the Vietnam War, and there were all of these war crimes committed by American soldiers against the Vietnamese people, civilians, women, children. Very little made it to the press, and it was us, the activists, the students, who were protesting because we had heard about these things and we wanted to see accountability on the part of American soldiers. Who was tried? This insignificant Lieutenant William Calley, instead of trying General Maxwell Taylor, instead of holding the hires up accountable for the systematic crimes being committed in Vietnam, and for decades now, since the beginning of the so-called War on Terror, we've had a problem of so-called secret prisons, the problem of extraordinary renditions. Mm-hmm. And my colleague and rapporteur on human rights while combating terrorism, Ben Emerson, did a study on extraordinary renditions. And it turned out that 54 countries in the world participated in the extraordinary renditions. And countries like Poland, Romania, Egypt, etc., all participated in this completely illegal program of kidnapping and sending people to be tortured. I mean, we had special agreements with Egypt, and we sent people specifically to be tortured in Egypt. Wow. And, of course, we continued the torture in Guantanamo. And as I said, in total impunity, because no one has ever been held accountable.
Okay. Now, let me also invite senior analyst with Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, out of New York. Good to have you with us, sir. Ian, rights groups argue that allowing private security firms like Blackwater to operate with impunity in armed conflicts will embolden the states to circumvent their obligations under humanitarian law. Is that true?
Yes, quite clearly. I was present at the first, the negotiations that led to the signing of the UN, of the International Criminal Court. Mm-hmm. And I spoke to a lot of the State Department and U.S. military analysts and lawyers who were involved. And their sincere thesis was that because the law only allowed for prosecution if the state concerned had failed, then it was okay. You know, Americans were protected because they said, we have the best military justice system in the world. I had memories of Milei, like our other interlocutor there, where you might remember it took something like 30 years for the pilot of the helicopter that stopped the massacre to be recognized by Bill Clinton. But Bill Clinton was the president at the time and was at least paying lip service when the treaty was signed. We know that the U.S. couldn't ratify it because of Republican opposition, and it's on the basic same principle. The U.S. can never do any wrong. I mean, it's American exceptionalism to the max. First of all, the U.S. can do no wrong, and secondly, that anyone wearing a uniform must be supported, which we're seeing with police impunity, with military impunity. Now, okay, he shot somebody in full daylight who was unarmed, but he's a policeman doing his duty, so we must support him. It's that attitude that pervades the whole system, and it really has come out here because these people were that they were paid security guards, that they were like the doorman in a nightclub. I mean, it's like giving the bouncer in a nightclub the option to kill people at will. And internationally, that's how it will be seen. This was a clear massacre. Not the only one, by the way. They haven't even tried to investigate the massacre in the square that WikiLeaks revealed, where a helicopter up in the air gunned down a Reuters camera crew and then gunned down the people who went to rescue them and give them medical aid. That hasn't even been investigated yet, let alone prosecuted. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is a whole level of impunity which needs examination. Of course, we know, in fact, that the people who leaked that, they are being persecuted by the government, but not the people who kept it secret, who did it, who ordered it, who provided the circumstances, empowered those people to go in and kill civilians. And it's bad for the U.S. in every way, not just morally, but if you're going to be cynical, it means that their word is worth nothing when it comes to looking for war criminals abroad. Who would hand over somebody to the United States as a suspected war criminal, knowing the United States' partial record, where they protect the guilty when it's theirs and persecute the innocent when they're foreigners?
Okay. Now back to Geneva. Alfred, UN rights experts are also warning that pardons and amnesties, I'm quoting them, open doors for future abuses when states use the service of private military and security companies for inherent state functions. Do you share the same opinion?
Well, I've written that in some of my old reports to the Human Rights Council and to the General Assembly. Indeed, in the ontology of the state is to keep an army and to keep discipline in that army. The main problem with private security companies is that it's an attempt to outsource this ontological responsibility of the state. And there the so-called status of forces abroad agreements that essentially grant them total immunity in the countries where they're operating, in this case Iraq, on the assumption that if they commit a crime, that they will be under in personam jurisdiction of United States courts, and that the military will actually investigate those allegations of war crimes, and that those responsible will be brought to justice. Well, here we have four individuals from Blackwater who were in fact brought to court and convicted back in 2014 for murder. It is a disgrace for a country under the rule of law that it would be tolerated that a crime as egregious as this one would be subject to pardoning. But as Mr. Trump said, These were people who had a long history of service to our nation, and therefore they deserve being pardoned. Now, this is like a mafia boss saying, well, they're my boys. You know, my boys are good boys. And that, when I was a young student in high school in Chicago, I mean, I remember the kind of daily indoctrination, if you want. You know, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What does that mean? Is that we are indoctrinated in believing that we, Americans, are, by definition, the good guys. We're always the good guys. Our soldiers do not commit war crimes. Our private military security officers do not commit war crimes. Only the other side commits war crimes. And that's why what we need is universal jurisdiction.
Right.
So that countries other than the United States, when an American official goes to, say, Switzerland, that if he is, say, the Minister of Defense, and he comes to Switzerland, well, he has responsibility for all the war crimes that have been committed under his jurisdiction,
right,
if he has not ensured accountability.
Mm-hmm.
So universal jurisdiction is a concept that has to be played in.
Right. Now, Ian, in a statement announcing this controversial pardons just a few days ago, the White House said that the move was broadly supported by the public and also backed by a number of Republican lawmakers. Is that really the case?
Well, I'm fairly sure it was backed by a large number of Republican lawmakers, because they're looking over their shoulders at the Trump supporters who will or won't vote for them. I mean, you know, if Adolf Hitler had the good sense to wear a GI's uniform, these people would all be supporting him, no problem. But on the other side, if they were putting, when we're talking about the public, is the public aware of it? That's the real problem. And I think my colleague here was making the point, the public is not aware of most of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
If you ask them about Milei, it's not on their list of battles. If you ask them about Abu Ghraib, if you ask them about Guantanamo, this is not big on the mental horizon. It's an issue that's buried very thoroughly. If it's brought up at all by the media, it's very likely, because the media has exactly the same prejudices. Our guys are right, the other side are wrong. If our guys are wrong now and again, then we should cut them some slack, because they're doing this for us after all. I mean, there is a cult of the uniform and the veteran here in the United States, which pervades everything. A veteran can do no wrong. In fact, lots of veterans do wrong. And, you know, the whole point of people in uniform is you're training them to go abroad and kill people.
Mm-hmm.
And they often do it, excessively and with too much zeal. And so people do feel sympathy for them. You know, I've spoken, everyone calls the Second World War the finest war. I've spoken to many veterans who tell horrifying stories about what happened to prisoners who fell into their hands if they were inconvenient. And but they're just ignored. People know about them, but the reality is obscured to preserve this overall vision that the United States is a city on a hill. It's not just the United States, of course. Lots of other countries. The British have never held responsible those who committed atrocities in Kenya or in South Yemen or in India, come to think of it. The other places where they're involved. The French have never come to terms with Algeria. So, you know, it's not a uniquely American problem,
right,
but it is, because America is, the United States is the sort of founding partner of the United Nations, keeps saying it's taking action to uphold international law. Its actions against Iran are wreathed in the obligations to under international law and order, and yet it completely flouts it whenever it suits them. And in this particular case, there were options. I mean, Donald Trump could have said, oh, well, look, these guys, they were young, they're in a terrible situation, so I'll exercise clemency. we'll commute the sentences. But he didn't. He said a pardon. And the pardon implies this is all right, that they are, in effect, judicially speaking, innocent.
Yeah, but I wonder if Trump knows the difference between pardon and clemency. Now,
but it's a tough call. I agree.
All right. Alfred, you both talked about, Ian talked about global jurisdiction. The ICC, ICJ, I mean, the U.S. does not recognize, these international tribunals. So we have had a long record of the U.S. doing things, similar things since the Korea War, the things that the U.S. did in Afghanistan, the UN probe about it and all that. So is there a remedy to this exceptionalism, U.S. forces always being good guys, infallible, great, guys who never do anything wrong?
Well, it's up to us Americans to make sure that our fellow Americans, shall we say, grow up and realize that exceptionalism is not the way forward. But we still live in this bubble, and we still believe that we are the good guys. And it took me decades, actually, to separate myself from that, to, say, jump over my own shadow, to think outside the box. Not everybody does that. Here you are in your comfort zone. But while we're talking about universal jurisdiction, I mean, this can be done, and actually it has occurred. Back years ago, 2007 or 2008, when Donald Rumsfeld went to a right-wing group to speak in Paris, he had to escape because there was a warrant for his arrest. And he left Paris, and he went into Germany, and was flown back to the United States with a military plane. So you see that there is a possibility under international law to prosecute for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and under the Convention Against Torture, which the United States has ratified.
Right.
Under the Convention Against Torture, there is an obligation of the territorial state to arrest and try whatever person is within its jurisdiction, in its territory, like Donald Rumsfeld at that moment,
right,
who is accused of having committed torture. That is, not he personally, but he as the responsible minister whose soldiers committed torture in Guantanamo and elsewhere. Let me just say one point.
Okay, we have only a few seconds left.
Assange and Snowden, we demand absolutely, and we must demand as Americans that the president grant pardon both to Julian Assange and to Edward Snowden, both of whom are human rights defenders.
Okay.
And they have done more for the world than many others, and I think that the campaign against Assange is disgraceful. My colleague Niels Meltzer, rapporteur on torture, has specifically written to Donald Trump and demanded a pardon for...
Okay, Alfred, unfortunately, that's all the time we have. We are out of time. Thank you very much for your comments. We had senior analyst with Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, out of New York, and former independent expert with the UN Human Rights Council, Alfred Desaias, out of Geneva. And your host, Behrouz Najafi.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
ولو قد يسرنا القرآن. towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful, Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, which was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. We start from where we left you last week, and here is Ayah 21 of Surah Jathiyah.
أَمْ حَسِبَ الَّذِينَ اجْتَرَحُوا السَّيِّئَاتِ أَنْ نَجْعَلَهُمْ كَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ سَوَاءً مَحْيَاهُمْ وَمَمَاتُهُمْ سَاءَ مَا يَحْكُمُونَ.
Do those who have perpetrated misdeeds suppose that we shall treat them as those who have faith and do righteous deeds, their life and death being equal? Evil is the judgment they make. Remember, in our last episode of this series, a fortnight ago, while explaining the previous ayahs of this surah, we said Islam, which is culmination of the messages preached by the prophets of the past, reached perfection through the universal mission revealed to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. We also said faith is based on insight and awareness in order to guide others with certitude, while piety makes a person deserving of divine protection, since one of the characteristics of the pious is their abstaining from the meaningless goals and desires of the ignorant and deviated elements. The Noble Quran is the source of insight and knowledge in all ideological, ethical, social, political, and family matters, which means that those who adhere to the letter and spirit of its teachings are believers, while those who do not believe in it are disbelievers. Thus, the ayah that we recited to you now draws a comparison between a believer and a disbeliever, saying the two cannot be equal in the sight of God, the just and the all-merciful, who has given ample time and opportunities for the sinners and the faithless to repent and reform themselves. In other words, those who continue in the state of disbelief and misdeeds are neither equal to the believers and the virtuous while alive nor after death. Indeed, evil and unjustified are the expectations of the disbelievers and the judgment they make by thinking they are equal with those who are patient and resigned to the will of God, irrespective of being healthy or sick, poor or rich, and experiencing the ups or downs of life. On the contrary, disbelievers are always in distress and anxiety, even if they enjoy all bounties and live in luxury and wealth. At the time of death, these two groups will have quite different fates. The believers will be given tidings of paradise, and the disbelievers the news of the fires of hell awaiting them. From this ayah, we learn, number one, God is just and the all-merciful, and certainly the believers and disbelievers are not equal in his sight. Number two, the criterion for reward or punishment is our own deeds rather than undue wishes. And number three, those who are undeserving because of their misdeeds and moreover are not inclined to repent, reform, and rectify their faults should not further deceive themselves through wise expectations or make irrational judgments. Now we listen to ayah 22 of the same surah.
وخلق الله السماوات والأرض بالحق ولتجزى كل نفس بما كسبت وهم لا يظلمون.
Allah created the heavens and the earth with reason, so that every soul may be requited for what it has earned, and they will not be wronged. This ayah substantiates the preceding one that dismissed the notion of disbelievers and believers being equal to each other as nothing but wishful thinking. Here, the Almighty Creator means to say that He, the All-Wise, has created the heavens and the earth with reason and with a purpose to make truth prevail over falsehood. It refers to the fact that the All-Merciful God, who has created the universe in perfect order for the benefit of mankind, the best of creation, will not wrong anyone, the least, which means those who believe and lead a virtuous life will indeed reap the rewards, while those persisted in disbelief, sins, and misdeeds, despite the long respite given to them to correct their behavior, has wronged themselves and hence suffer the consequences of their own evil ways. From this ayah we learn, number one, the entire creation is based on justice and with a purpose behind, which means every person will be judged in a fair and merciful manner on the basis of the deeds he or she did while alive. Number two, the day of judgment will see the final triumph of truth and justice over falsehood and oppression. And number three, the all-loving Creator never wrongs anyone, and it is only we who wrong ourselves by refusing to believe in truth and righteousness while persisting in disobedience of God and indulgence in sins and oppression of others. Now we listen to ayah 23 of Surah Jathiyah.
أَفَرَأَيْتَ مَنِ اتَّخَذَ إِلَاهَهُ هَوَاهُ وَأَضَلَّهُ اللَّهُ عَلَى عِلْمٍ وَخَتَمَ عَلَى سَمْعِهِ وَقَلْبِهِ وَجَعَلَ عَلَى بَصَرِهِ غِشَاوَةً فَمَنْ يَهْدِيهِ مِنْ بَعْدِ اللَّهِ أَفَلَا تَذَكَّرُونَ.
Have you seen him who has taken his desire to be his God and whom Allah has left astray knowingly and set a seal upon his hearing and his heart and put a blindfold on his sight? So who will guide him after Allah? Will you not then take admonition? When those who follow vain desires and regard pursuit of carnal pleasures as their goals in life or objects of worship, these sins will block their capability to the hearing of good, harden and darken their hearts toward perception of facts, and blur their vision to the aesthetic beauty of the world of creation. As a result, the words of truth may not affect them to the extent that the All-Merciful God, who had provided them ample opportunities to discern between good and evil, leaves them astray to their own fate, since they have spurned all means of guidance. In other words, God has made available to mankind the means of deliverance from error. But when a person persists in disbelief, unbridled misdeeds, unabated sins, and habitual oppression of others, such persons deprive themselves of divine guidance. In other words, it is not divine will to leave such persons astray, but it is their own drifting away from guidance and immersion in sins and wanton pleasures that make them deserving of divine wrath. In this way, the Lord Most High exhorts us to take admonition. From this ayah we learn the following points. Number 1. Deities have differed in form throughout history, ranging from the worship of wooden or stone objects by the deviated ones to prostrations to the sun and the moon, as well as blind pursuit of carnal desires to the extent of adorning them. Number 2. Indulgence in evil ways and immersion in sins deprive persons of seeing or hearing facts and realities, with the mind losing its power of rationality and the heart becoming devoid of faith, compassion, and humanitarian values. Let us now listen to ayahs 24 and 25 of the same surah.
وقالوا ما هي إلا حياتنا الدنيا نموت ونحيا وما يهلكنا إلا الدهر وما لهم بذلك من علم إن هم إلا يظنون وإذا تتلى عليهم آياتنا بينات ما كان حجتهم إلا أن قالوا ائتوا بآبائنا إن كنتم صادقين.
They say, there is nothing but the life of this world. We live and we die, and nothing but time destroys us. But they do not have any knowledge of that, and they only make conjectures. And when our manifest signs are recited to them, their only argument is to say, bring our fathers back to life, should you be truthful. The Arabic word dahr in ayah 24 denotes the passage of time. Materialists devoid of faith in God and belief in the day of resurrection and divine judgment claim that the passage of life, time leads to human perdition, since they follow vain desires and are oblivious of spiritual values. Their minds fail to understand the signs around them of the majesty of God, and their hearts lose perception of realities, thereby making them deny resurrection and judgment. As a result, they regard existence restricted to life and death, with nothing afterwards. They thus follow the dictum, make most of life without regard for good or evil, wrong or right, virtue or vice, and that everything is destroyed by the passage of time. It is obvious their words are not substantiated by proper knowledge, since their intellect has lost the power to discern certitude from conjecture. As the next ayah means to say, when the ayahs of the Noble Quran are recited as manifest signs of God Almighty, instead of pondering upon facts, the disbelievers retort that if the prophets are truthful, then raise our forefathers back to life so that we ask them what had transpired after death. In other words, they fail to grasp the finer points of divine wisdom in providing plenty of signs in the world of nature and in the human being itself of the long respite given to understand the eventuality of resurrection. From these ayahs, we learn that, number 1, blind pursuit of materialistic life with immersion in sins deprives a person of faith in God and thereby denial of the hereafter. Number 2, there is no logical argument for the disbeliever's denial of resurrection. And number 3, it is the height of absurdity to demand that their dead are immediately brought back to life. Thank you.
morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.